Broad City. As we just have a minute to go, your final thoughts on what this all means. And again, there were other slur words, too, like the N-word.
Yeah, you know, I do. My Jewish identity means a lot to me. And I, you know, I implore other Jews to align themselves with those who are also othered in this country. You know, this country was built on the backs of black and brown bodies. And Jews are in this weird middle space. But we are all othered. But we are all, as a unit, we are strong and can stand up and make change in these midterm elections. I'm just so, I hope that we do. I really hope that we do. Our voices matter. And we have to be a little more strategic about our safety. But we can make change very
imminently. Ilana Glazer, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ilana Glazer, comedian, writer, actress, co-creator, star of the hit Comedy Central show Broad City. You can go to our website to see the images at democracynow.org. A very fond farewell to our dear producer, Laura Gottesdiener. I have no words. Thank you so much for all of your contributions here over these years.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Here to Stay, an artist book fair the weekend of November 2nd through 4th at Matter in Portland. Here to Stay is a celebration of publication as art. The opening will be Friday from 5 to 9, and weekend events include tea tasting, book fair, art exhibition, and more. Participants include Just Seeds Artist Cooperative, Signal Fire, Eberhardt Press, Works Progress Agency, and many other artists, writers, and activists. Again, that's Here to Stay, an artist book fair the weekend of November 2nd through 4th at Matter, 811 East Burnside Street, number 124 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I don't know if I know all the words or not, but I'm going to try to sing it for you.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Wild in the Streets on Wednesday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. A freaked-out 60s exploitation movie, Wild in the Streets follows Max Frost and the Troopers, a psychedelic rock band that managed to take over the United States after the voting age is lowered to 16. The new regime legalizes all drugs, puts everyone over 30 into acid re-education camps, and creates a new hippie fascist utopia. Again, that's Wild in the Streets on Wednesday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years.
Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten-Free Gem, Wee Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give
or call 503-231-8032. You are also invited to show up in real life tonight.
KBOO and 150 other nonprofits will be at the Give Guide kickoff party at No Vacancy Lounge with food, music, and raffles.
Doors open at 8 p.m. This is a 21 and over event.
Support KBOO,
where music makes the movement.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:03. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon governor's race is breaking spending records.
Protesters were attacked in downtown Portland.
And in international news, the U.S. is threatening war with Iran.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, November 2nd, 2018. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker. According to Secretary of State and the Willamette Week, the Oregon governor's race is setting new marks for campaign spending. Republican Newt Bueller has raised over $5 million and Kate Brown over $8 million. Bueller takes his big chucks with $1 million from Nike founder Phil Knight and $750,000 from the National Republican Party. Kate Brown's biggest contribution was $100,000 from a California tech investor, Steve Silberstein. In the Portland City Council race, Loretta Smith raised roughly $200,000 more than Joanne Hardesty. Smith's largest donors include $80,000 from the Quillen Morgan family, $26,000 from Local 48 Electricians PAC, and $20,000 from United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. Hardesty's largest donors are $10,000 from Portland Metropolitan Employees Union, $6,500 from Raymore Construction, and $5,000 from Mary Hardesty, her ex-mother-in-law. Overall, Smith has outraised Hardesty nearly 2-1. However, Hardesty has more donations, which comply with proposed measure winning over Smith 2-1.
Some changes are taking place at the Portland Water Bureau. To minimize neurotoxins in water, the United States Environmental Protection Agency published the lead and copper rule back in 1991. This rule established a maximum containment level goal of zero for lead in drinking water. The Portland Water Bureau has never met the goal and is rolling out an education plan as an alternative compliance method. For more, KABU's Joe Meyer spoke with Portland water activist Dee White.
The Portland Water Bureau is currently spending $500 million to build a treatment plant in Bull Run. According to the Water Bureau, this construction work is necessitated by the EPA regulation known as LT2. According to water activists, however, this regulation didn't make sense for our protected Bull Run water, and that City Hall could have easily substituted water testing for the costly and unnecessary construction projects. In fact, Rochester, New York succeeded in substituting testing for the infrastructure projects and still to this day enjoys the benefits of open reservoirs. In sharp contrast to the ready complicity with LT2, Commissioner Fritz of the Water Bureau is rolling out an alternative to the EPA's lead and copper rule. I asked water activist Dee White what she expects of the Water Bureau.
Start an immediate program to aggressively, unidirectionally, high-velocity flush and clean our pipes. They're highly corroded. A lot of them need replacing. A lot of the lead problem is coming from the corrosion and the biofilm that's being released with these chemicals. Portland treats its water with chloramine, which is really, really bad for corroding pipes as opposed to chlorine. They can flush the pipes, number one. Number two, they need to aggressively up their treatment of anti-corrosion chemicals. They're not doing it right now. That's why there's so much lead leaching from the tap, from our plumbing. They continuously blame customer plumbing. Nick Fish and not Amanda Fritz, but so far, Nick Fish has continuously blamed customers' plumbing, whereas the federal law requires it's regulated at the tap. It's not up to the people to fix the lead in the water by changing their plumbing. It's up to the Water Bureau to fix the water so that it's not as corrosive.
Amanda Fritz is now in charge of the Water Bureau. Do you expect any changes?
I do not. I was hopeful that there would be. I had a meeting with her policy director on water quickly after Amanda got the role of commissioner of the Water Bureau. And I was completely amazed that when I walked in, the policy director literally looked at me, put her hands down on the table and said, "What you got for me?" That completely threw me off because I was expecting to go in and talk to her about possibly changing the policy. But there's so much money on the table, Joe. There's so much money on the table with this $500 million filtration plant. It's going to be so hard for them to get to walk away from that because to fix the pipes, to do all the infrastructure work that they need to do on our old crumbling infrastructure is going to cost much more than that. And yet they're trying to prioritize this first before they fix the lead. There's no guarantee that this corrosion control treatment project, all they can say is that they hope that it improves the lead. They don't say it will, and they hope it will. And it's my opinion, and the opinion of a biochemist that I know, is that it could make it worse. So,
why are they spending the money on that filtration plant?
For an intestinal malady as a result of the LT2 rule passed about several years after the lead and copper rule was passed. It was passed, the LT2 rule was passed based on a sewage event in Milwaukee where a whole bunch of people got sick from the drinking water that had been contaminated by sewage. They fast-tracked the rule so that for the industry, so that more water industry people, engineering companies, could build these expensive, costly filtration plants across the nation. And Portland, having the federally protected watershed that they have, there's no chance that anyone's going to get sick from cryptosporidium coming from Bull Run water. At the same time, they're getting the threat of a neurotoxin in over 10% of our old homes and schools, businesses, playgrounds. The threat of that is so much more horrible. It's a neurotoxin. And the fact that they're building this filtration plant to treat a threat that does not exist up at Bull Run. There's only two strains of cryptosporidium that makes people sick, just with flu-like or stomach malady, and that's the parvum and the hominum, which is the human and the cow strains. And as you know, with the federally protected watershed being the biggest barrier of all, the most ultimate barrier to parasites such as this, no humans and cows are allowed up there.
What did Commissioner French say when you brought this to her?
This is her first response today, was that, hey, Nick, it's me. Her first response that I've heard from her was today after I gave my speech, and she tried to criticize me for not being there for their wonderful presentation on their alternative rule to the lead and copper rule. And, in fact, I did watch it on TV. I watch everything on TV. I would ask them to please contact the city council and ask them to straighten out their policy, start fixing the lead immediately, as the EPA has been asking them to do for 20 years. Call them and say, we do not need a filtration plant. We do not need to be paid for a filtration plant. We need to be paying for you to deliver us safe water.
That was Portland water activist Dee White. Commissioner Fritz's Water Bureau is pursuing an alternative compliance to the EPA's lead and copper regulation. Education will be substituted for bringing lead levels into compliance. Meanwhile, Portland water consumers are paying $500 million for unnecessary construction at Bull Run. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
Native American Rights Fund and partners in a voting rights coalition. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Nebraska Supreme Court heard arguments Thursday about the permitting process for the Keystone XL pipeline. One attorney in the courtroom appeared on behalf of the Yankton Sioux Tribe of South Dakota. Jennifer Baker says the required consultation of tribes has not been completed, and surveys of historical and cultural resources were not done for the alternative route approved in Nebraska. Victoria Wicks reports.
Jennifer Baker tells justices that TransCanada did studies on its preferred pipeline route in 2008, and it is those studies the Nebraska Public Service Commission considered when permitting an alternative route in 2017. Baker says surveys identifying historical and cultural resources have not yet been completed on the alternative route.
Without surveys and the results of those surveys, there's insufficient evidence for the PSC to make a determination about how those resources would be harmed. They don't know what's there, so they don't know what harm could happen.
Consultation with tribes is a requirement of the Keystone XL pipeline, Baker tells Nebraska justices that there's a difference in perspective between tribes and government officials.
The United States would argue that they engaged in consultation. The tribes would argue that they absolutely failed the consultation. There was nothing meaningful about it.
Baker outlines what responses are in place when pipeline workers encounter artifacts. She says construction will cease, and the state historical preservation officer, the tribes, and the U.S. State Department will decide how to proceed.
But the biggest point I'd like to make with respect to this programmatic agreement is that it does not apply to the mainline alternative route. It's a site-specific agreement.
Attorneys for TransCanada and the Public Service Commission told justices that hearings were held where tribes and landowners could testify on the alternative route, and that it has been determined that the pipeline will cause little or no environmental damage. The Nebraska Supreme Court will issue an opinion at a later date. Construction on the pipeline is scheduled to begin in spring. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Northwest tribes will get money from the U.S. Department of Justice to fund attorneys who will focus on domestic violence. Emily Schwing has more.
In a press release, U.S. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said holding perpetrators accountable and providing victims with services is a critical part of the department's response to violence against women. To that end, Rosenstein announced funding to support four new tribal special assistant U.S. attorneys. They'll collaborate with federal and tribal jurisdictions. In a prepared statement, Colville Tribal Chairman Rodney Costin said the effects of violence against women are far-reaching.
Violence against women and girls not only affects the victim, but also our children, our families, and our communities.
Nearly $440,000 will go to fund attorneys with the Colville Tribes in northeastern Washington and the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla in Oregon. Funding will also go to tribes in Arizona and South Dakota. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
The Native American Rights Fund and partners in a voting rights coalition unveiled a new website this week. VoteNARF.org includes the findings of the coalition's multi-year research on the state of voting in Indian country, which surveyed and documented obstacles Native voters face. The nonpartisan group is made up of national and grassroots organizations, scholars, and advocates seeking equal access for Native Americans to the political process. The Ponca Tribe of Nebraska opened its Prairie Flower Casino this week on the Iowa-Nebraska border, despite state and local legal challenges. The tribe says the casino is creating jobs and will boost the economy. The more than 9,000-square-foot building in Carter Lake features only slot machines. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
As an American Indian or Alaska Native, you help elders, young people, and Native businesses when you exercise your right to vote November 6th. Your vote makes a difference in Washington, D.C. and at home. Go to nativevote.org for more information. Brought to you by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Bread and Roses, and at 7, it's The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather calls for partly cloudy skies and a high tomorrow of 57. Expect some drizzle. Today in history, the North Vietnamese Congress rejected peace talks. The quote of the day is from Ho Chi Minh, who said, quote, "Remember, the storm is a good time for the pine and the cypress to show their strength," end quote. In Minya, Egypt, terrorists opened fire and murdered 7 Coptic Christians on buses from St. Samuel, the Confessor Monastery. 14 of the wounded people were rushed to the hospital in Beni Mazar. A similar attack occurred in May of 2017 when 28 Coptic Christians were murdered while traveling on a bus to another monastery. Earlier in 2017, over 40 Coptic Christians were killed and an estimated 120 wounded when 2 churches were bombed. Religious extremists linked to Daesh and ISIS have been openly targeting Christians and taking credit for the attacks. Coptic Christians make up around 10% of the Egyptian population. After President Morsi was removed from office in 2013, the violence against Christians increased. The Egyptian government has been treating the attacks on Christians as acts of terrorism. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi publicly mourned the victims, calling them martyrs and condemning these acts as terrorism. The Egyptian government is still suffering from economic and social instabilities following the Arab Spring in 2011. The military has launched an offensive called Sinai 2018. Its aim is to fight religious extremists. So far, the Egyptian military has killed 450 jihadists in this offensive.
The United States government is engaging in pre-war sanctions and belligerent statements against Iran in a manner reminiscent of the run-up to the war with Iraq. Though the U.S. State Department and all signatory nations have certified that Iran is in compliance with terms of the denuclearization deal signed under the Obama administration, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Security Advisor John Bolton have been issuing statements threatening Iran with escalations of sanctions up to and including war with the United States. Starting Monday, the U.S. will devastate a third of the Iranian economy by cutting off oil exports. At the same time, Pompeo has been issuing the stock denials of imperialism, claiming that the U.S. does not want war. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani responded to the aggression Wednesday by saying Washington's plans to starve the Iranian economy constitute a, quote, new instance of oppression by America. He appealed for national unity in the face of the threat and implied that Iran would be able to evade the sanctions by selling the oil anyway. Iran is facing a considerable revolt from its working class as theocratic regime continues to impose strict social restrictions. The mullahs have also been unwilling to fairly distribute the wealth that is available in the country. The U.S. sanctions and threats serve to unite the population even as they increase stress and poverty for the average Iranian. The country is surrounded with U.S. bases, and the Persian Gulf is bristling with U.S. warships, including the USS Essex, with 1,800 Marines and sailors.
Family and supporters of Patrick Kimmons, who was killed last month by Portland police, have been harassed by right-wing gang members and struck by an angry motorist as they blocked the downtown street where Kimmons was gunned down. Kimmons was shot several times in the back by the police, but the grand jury has absolved them of any wrongdoing. Activists have been holding a daily demonstration to call on the Portland Police Bureau to release more video and to cease these extrajudicial executions. Members of the Proud Boys white supremacist gang have been reported to be confronting the protesters, and a white man was arrested earlier this week for aggressively ramming into a protester with his car. That driver was Mark Davidson, 55, and he's charged with assault, reckless endangerment, and reckless driving after striking one of the protesters downtown Wednesday. The protester did not seek medical attention.
Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford was flying on Delta's Republic Airlines en route to Boston from Indianapolis last Tuesday when she came to the aid of a passenger in medical distress. Stanford, a research scientist and teacher at Boston General and a licensed physician, showed her credentials to a flight attendant before aiding the passenger. The flight attendant then sharply questioned her status as a doctor and asked to see her medical license a second time as Dr. Stanford attempted to aid the passenger. Dr. Stanford is black. After examining her medical license multiple times, the flight attendant questioned whether Stanford was, quote, really a doctor. Following her experience on the flight, Dr. Stanford wrote about her experience on social media. Delta Airlines tweeted in response, quote, I am sorry for your frustration, Dr. Stanford. Please know that Delta does not condone discrimination for any reason, and we take your comments very seriously. We are looking into this further and will be reaching out to you directly, end quote. In fact, Delta changed its internal policies after a similar incident in 2016 in which Dr. Tamika Cross says she was rebuffed by flight attendants and prevented from offering help to a sick passenger. The Delta personnel instead let a white male doctor treat the passenger. On Twitter, Dr. Stanford expressed disappointment that Delta had not been effective in changing its policy.
An employee at Goodwill in Fort Worth, Texas, was casually searching through new donations when she pulled out a massive albino serpent dangling out of the donation bin. She took one look and, like anyone else, freaked out and took off running. She ran to her coworker, who surprisingly knew a lot about snakes and had been an owner of a few. The coworker, Murphy, jumped into action. Quote, "With pythons, they're very strong, and they are constrictors, so if he didn't want to let go of that bin, it wouldn't have been hard. It would have been very hard to get him off without hurting him," end quote. "We tried to coax him to start slithering to relax his muscles, and that's when I started holding him. Eventually, he relaxed enough for me to get him in the bin. The other workers were shocked and were asking lots of questions and want to know, how did the python get there, and what are they supposed to do now?" Murphy said, quote, "I don't know if someone may have maliciously donated it. Maybe they wanted to get rid of it but weren't sure how," end quote. For now, Murphy and his staff are taking care of the snake, hoping that its original owner comes forward.
And now it's time for the Middle East Minute.
I'm SD Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. As reported at the Electronic Intifada, on Monday, a federal judge in San Francisco finally dismissed a frivolous lawsuit after three attempts by the pro-Israel Lawfare Project to silence Palestinian-American professor Dr. Rabab al-Dahadi at San Francisco State University. The plaintiffs accused San Francisco State and Dr. al-Dahadi of violating Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, using a legal strategy that claims universities fail to protect Jewish students by not cracking down on Palestine solidarity activism. That strategy was pioneered by Kenneth Marcus, a far-right Israel advocate who was confirmed earlier this year as the director of the Office for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education. In his decision, Judge Orrick noted that the plaintiffs have had ample opportunities to attempt to state their Title VI claims but have not been able to do so. Palestine Legal's Liz Jackson told the Electronic Intifada it is a significant defeat for both Lawfare as a legal bullying strategy and the Lawfare Project as an organization. In other news, the Washington Post reported yesterday that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu asked the United States to stand by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman after the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Post cited information from U.S. officials familiar with phone conversations made to Jared Kushner, son-in-law and senior advisor to President Trump, and National Security Advisor John Bolton regarding the case. While several world leaders have shunned the Crown Prince and called for a halt on arms sales to Saudi Arabia, Trump and Netanyahu have supported the Saudi version of events. Israel's relations with the Saudis have flourished under bin Salman, who is presumed to be central to the long-awaited Trump deal of the century peace proposal between Israel and Palestine. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 2nd, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Teresa Mitchell, Tammy Habateas, and Joe Meyer. The producer is Teresa Mitchell, and our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The director of the Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to organizers and healthcare professionals about the benefits of the Clean Energy Initiative Measure 26-201. At 11, the Radio Zone welcomes author Philip Kenny to discuss his new book, The Writer's Crucible, Meditations on Emotion, Being, and Creativity. And at 11:30, Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside of Mental Health. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Jasmine. Good night, Jenna.
Night,
Good
Jenna.
Good night, everybody. Time is 4:29, and we're just coming up here on 5:30 on a Friday, which means it's time for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, there's a reason the man who murdered 11 Jewish people in a Pittsburgh synagogue also ranted online about some thousands of mostly women and children making their way from Honduras to the U.S.-Mexico border to seek asylum. It's the same reason torch-wielding marchers chanting, "Jews will not replace us," in Charlottesville in 2015, stopped to beat up a black man. White supremacists connect Jewish people and black people and immigrants and LGBTQ people and uppity women in a worldview about an existential threat to themselves as white Christian Americans. Other people also have a worldview that connects Jews, black and brown,